argument now in the case of United States against Smith. Mr. Fitzgibbon, you can raise the podium if you want. There's a switch on your right-hand side.
It's fine. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Appellant Robert Smith respectfully requests that this Court reverse his conviction because the District Court committed numerous prejudicial evidentiary errors that affected his right to a fair trial.
Of the alleged problems that you point out at trial, which one do you consider to be the most problematic and why?
I think that's a close call, Your Honor. I think perhaps the most problematic would be the government's violation of its Rule 16b violations. The District Court actually acknowledged that the government failed to produce a letter that Smith wrote but never sent to Lisa Kerr. But the District Court found this omission harmless. This error was not harmless, however. This failure to produce this letter was not harmless, however, because it was used by the government to impeach Smith's testimony regarding the timeline of his feelings for Lisa Kerr, and as well as show a continued pattern of obsessive behavior towards her.
Well, you argued in your brief that Smith could have reduced the sting of that letter by testifying on direct as to why he didn't send it. But couldn't Smith have made that point on redirect?
Well, that would have been a possibility, Your Honor. However, there were two problems. First of all, instead of being able to take a preemptive strike, as Smith should have been able to, the damage was already done to a large extent during cross-examination. In addition, Smith's counsel was unprepared for this letter and was really taken by surprise. And so he did not have the days or weeks or months that he normally would have had to prepare for the use of such a letter. And this was harmful to Smith. Another harmful evidentiary error was the admission of the photograph of Smith making an obscene hand gesture to Leo Bick. Now, there is no probative value to this photograph whatsoever. There's already numerous evidence in the record showing that these two men had significant animosity for each other.
But, you know, Mr. Fitzgibbon, I have to say, I mean, first of all, going back to the Rule 16 violation for a second, the district court weighs that against all of the rest of the evidence in the case, obviously. District Court agrees with you that there was error, but just finds that the scientific evidence plus the circumstantial evidence make the case overwhelming. And, I mean, you would agree, at least, that that's the right inquiry. Maybe you don't find the evidence overwhelming, but it's up to the district judge to decide that. So that's one thing, and I'm just not sure that it's such a big thing that one could say the district judge weighed it incorrectly. And I wonder also about this photograph because, you know, you can think of a lot worse things somebody could be photographed doing than making an obscene gesture with a finger. I mean, I'm not sure that the jury would have been overwhelmed one way or the other by that. There was, okay, you know, here's this. We've heard lots of other testimony about the animosity between Mr. Smith and Mr. Bick. So here's one rather juvenile expression of it. How, in the light of this weighing process, can we say that this was such an egregious thing that it requires reversal?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we're not arguing that any of these errors in isolation.
No, you're making kind of a Santos argument, but these elements don't strike me individually and thus not in combination as something that so undermined the integrity of the jury's process that I just can't see which one would have really made that much difference. And even if you throw them all in together, why is it so important?
Well, Your Honor, in regard to the photograph, one of the key elements of the defense theory of what happened is that Leo Bick himself was a likely suspect in this case, as somebody who had the motivation to frame Robert Smith. And so an important issue for the jury is kind of weighing the credibility between these two individuals. Up until the presentation of this photograph, there was pretty even evidence in the record about the animosity between the two individuals.
Why wouldn't the photograph have suggested Mr. Bick's motive to do it? I don't see how it cuts so strongly against your theory.
Well, Your Honor, I guess taking into perspective the appearance of this photograph, I mean, this was taken apparently by Leo Bick, because the picture is of Smith giving the obscene gesture to the individual holding the camera.
But there was already evidence that Smith had punched Bick in the face. He banged Bick's car window. He threatened him physically, threatened him financially. Surely that all of that worse than a picture.
Well, Your Honor, there's also evidence of Bick making threats, taunts to Smith as well. I mean, Bick even sued Smith for battery, and when the case was thrown out, Bick accused the court system of being fixed. I mean, Bick is not a completely innocent person here, but when the jury sees a photograph of an individual making an obscene gesture, that when the jury sees this blown up picture, it's essentially a person looking at them making an obscene gesture. I mean, to me, that's prejudicial evidence, and without any probative value, it should not have been admitted. There was just no useful information that the jury gleaned from it. Also harmful was the denial of full use of a fingerprint expert for Smith. Now, the fingerprint evidence in this case was the most important physical evidence, because the latent fingerprint tied Smith to a Ziploc bag that was found as part of the pipe bomb contraption.
You know, I was interested in that because the district court denied his motion to allow the expert to perform additional testing without prejudice. Why didn't he renew the motion if the government didn't perform all the testing he had in mind?
Well, Your Honor, the testing should not have been contingent upon a renewal. Essentially, Smith desired examination of the fingerprints that could have already taken place at that time, at the time of the original motion. It wasn't contingent on work that had to be done later. There was no reason why the court couldn't have already gone ahead and ordered exemplars taken of all potential suspects in this case, which is what Smith wanted. Smith also wanted testing of bomb packaging material that was already available for such testing. And
so you're saying that Smith did move to have a fingerprint sample taken from Forrest once he found out that the FedEx label had fingerprints on it that did not match his own fingerprints?
No, Smith did not take any actions after the original motion for additional fingerprint examination, no.
And in particular, as I understand it, when the government comes back and says, we found three more potentially identifiable prints, Smith does not renew the motion. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
I mean, it seems to me, I mean, the district judge has a reason to keep some control over this. It costs money to do that, and the judge is a custodian of, you know, the proper procedures being used and responsible measures being taken. But once the three come back, I could certainly see potentially following up, and then maybe there would be reason to follow up some more. I know it takes time, but it looked like Judge Castillo left it quite open to do that.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, this wasn't a case where there was a fishing expedition going on. I mean, this was very narrow-focused fingerprint examination that was requested in the motion for additional examination. And I mean, Smith just wanted to test the fingerprint evidence that was already available against other possible suspects in this case.
But I thought the print that they did find of Smith was on the bag that was kind of inside the pipe. It was not just the outside of a package.
That's correct.
It was in a rather incriminating place.
That's correct, Your Honor. And because it was the most incriminating evidence in this case, I mean, that's why I don't believe that cost should have been that much of an issue, especially when Smith was requesting such narrow, focused additional examination. The district court's instruction during the government bomb expert's testimony also produced a likelihood of confusion for the jury on a very important issue. The government's bomb expert, at the beginning of his testimony, indicated that he was showing the jury an exact replica of the device that was used in this case. Said it
was are you claiming that the expert's description of the pipe bomb was too similar to the bomb allegedly used by Smith, or that his description was too different? Because at one point, you claimed that the bomb in this case had a fundamentally different wire setup than the one used by the expert. But then you say that the expert's description was too close to exactly what could have happened in this case. So I'm trying to figure out.
Smith's concern is that the it was very confusing to it, or there was a strong likelihood of confusion to the jury exactly how much this was an exact replica and how much this was a general demonstration of how pipe bombs work. The combination of the bomb expert's initial statements during his testimony and then the district court's instruction that this is just a demonstration put together on the basis of the witness's expertise, it's not necessarily what actually occurred.
Because what actually occurred was that the thing didn't work. Yeah. And the expert, luckily, and the expert had said, had offered some reasons why it hadn't worked. So the expert, in some sense, had to say to the jury, there's at least this material difference between what I've put together and there's like a little flash in the courtroom or something.
My interpretation of the district court's instruction was different, Your Honor, because the jury already knew that the bomb did not detonate. My interpretation was the district court, or at least a very likely interpretation by the jury, would be that the district court was instructing them that this wasn't necessarily an exact replica of the device, whether or not it actually detonated, that this was maybe just more of a teaching demonstration of how pipe bombs work and how they can potentially detonate. And this is an important distinction because the main purpose of the bomb expert's testimony was to provide the jury with an indication of whether or not the device in this case could have detonated.
Mr. Fitzgibbon, was there testimony in this case about how Mr. Smith might have learned how to make a pipe bomb or not, as the case may be?
There was some testimony in the record regarding Smith's moderate background in certain scientific engineering type of areas.
Okay.
The aggregate effect.
What were they? What are his credentials in that regard?
Your Honor, I'm afraid I don't remember exactly what they were offhand.
That's okay.
The aggregate effect of these preceding errors in a case that really as a tenuous evidence should warrant reversal. And the alternative, this court should vacate Smith's sentence because it violates the proportionality principle of the Eighth Amendment. Now, the package in this case that contained the device was subject to numerous rigors, and yet it never detonated. It was dropped, it was forcibly opened, and it never detonated.
But that's, of course, an ex post perspective. The government sees this as a case where, if you believe everything up to the point of Mr. Smith making the pipe bomb, it was one of attempted murder, and surely this is not a disproportionate sentence by anything the Supreme Court has ever said, if that's how you see it.
Well, Your Honor, I see it as a case with factual circumstances that are well covered by 18 U.S.C. 844I, which imposes a 20-year statutory maximum for such conduct, and that the government's use of a 924C enhancement in this case was inappropriate and led to a grossly disproportionate sentence. I should reserve my remaining time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Perry.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, I'd like to start with Judge Rovner's question regarding Mr. Smith's knowledge in this case. There was testimony, first of all, from Lisa Kerr regarding his handiness around the house, the fact that he always fixed electrical things that went wrong, that he was very good with that type of thing.
Thank God my husband is not.
Well, in addition to that, he was also a private investigator who had access to a kind of laboratory that he kept with soldering tools, with wires, with batteries, with a lot of the types of things that were in the bomb. In addition to that, He also had an electrical engineering-type background. He had taken courses at a community college in electrical engineering and had some kind of license. I don't believe it was an engineering license, but another type of electrical license that allowed him to do those things. Finally, although this evidence was not ultimately admitted by the district court, you will see in sidebar conversations discussions of a bomb-making book that was seen among his possessions, which the judge ultimately excluded from evidence because the judge felt that was more prejudicial than probative. With respect to the bomb expert in this case, I want to make it clear that the expert was not testifying about a device that was fundamentally different, that had a different wire setup. In the government's theory of the case, the model that the expert brought to court was a replica of what the expert believed the bomb would have looked like before it was ultimately dismantled by the bomb experts. The way the testimony reads, the expert starts out by talking about pipe bombs generally, then talks about all of the evidence that was received at the expert's laboratory regarding this case, then talks about how the expert put together the model, and finally, at the end of that, after showing the jury the model, does use a flashbulb filament, which was not in the actual device, which outside of the device, to create a small filament explosion to show how when those two wires would be connected with the cubic zirconium wire in the middle, there would be a slight amount of heat and fire created by that. Although it's not ultimately clear to me which part of this testimony the defendant is now objecting to, at trial, I believe the only part that was objected to was that small explosion that was created, as that was being, according to the defendant, unduly prejudicial. But as in terms of any confusion regarding the model that was created, that, in the expert's opinion, was a replica of the device. The reason the judge gave the cautionary instruction to the jury was because defendant had objected and said it is our theory that this is not what the device looked like. Therefore, the judge gave a cautionary instruction that the expert's testimony was an opinion, was not necessarily what actually occurred. But of course, in the government's theory, that actually was what would have occurred. It was the defendant's theory that something different would have occurred. And there's no evidence to support the defendant's theory that there was a different wire set up, apart from the defendant's own speculation on the stand and then defense counsel's arguments in closing that he believed the device was not intended to function. But according to the expert's testimony, it was. Now, moving on to the fingerprint expert, in our opinion, this was a fishing expedition. Is that
why the government opposed his motion for further fingerprinting?
That's exactly right, because at the time of the motion, there were no additional prints that needed comparing. And defendant was requesting numerous fingerprints. In fact, he requested a complete set of fingerprints, including palm prints, from every single person involved in the investigation. All of the investigators, one of whom, the main evidence custodian, had passed away, as well as from his alternative suspects, just random people in the community who the government did not believe was at all linked to the case. And in our opinion, had he wanted to obtain those random fingerprints, he could have also used a trial subpoena to do so.
You mean people other than Mr. Bick?
Other than Mr. Bick, the two individuals who he believed were the two Forrests, the husband and wife
Mr.
couple,
Forrest,
who
right, yeah.
We had no connection with and certainly were in no better position to secure their fingerprints than the defense was with the trial subpoena. So at that time, there was no basis for such a motion. And it was clear in the judge's ruling regarding this that he wasn't completely denying it, because he did order the government to go back to retest or at least look at all of the evidence that had been tested, because the defendant's theory was that with time, additional fingerprints would appear. Everything had already been tested and exposed to the chemicals involved in the fingerprint test.
So did the government actually retest the packaging for fingerprints as Smith's expert had wanted, or did it just test the FedEx label?
There were two things that the defendant specifically requested be tested in the first instance that had not been tested before. The government agreed at that hearing to do that, and then you can see from the trial testimony that those results were ultimately transmitted to the defense. At the hearing, the government had stated that they had already tested the other items. The defense counsel said, our expert feels that you didn't let it sit long enough before looking at it. After it had been exposed to the chemicals, it should have sat for a while and then should have been examined for fingerprints. And the government agreed at that hearing to go ahead and take that stuff back out of evidence and to look at it again. So it wasn't retested in the sense it wasn't re-exposed to chemicals, but the government did agree to go back and look to see if anything had appeared since it had been examined before.
Without using chemicals?
I believe it was a little confusing to me as well, Judge.
Well, they looked at it like this?
I believe that the defense expert was saying you have to expose it to the chemical, then you wait a certain period of time, and then the fingerprints will appear. I don't know if there's any basis in scientific fact for that.
Kind of like magic ink, isn't it? I mean, you put the stuff on, and then the
latent
prints.
I remember doing that when I was in second grade, I think.
The prints come out.
But if you read the transcript, that appears to be what defense counsel is requesting, and that is what the government agreed to do.
But that's when three more potentially testable sets of prints, in fact, do appear. So the defense
that was the items that had not previously been exposed to the elements.
Okay.
So the three that did magically appear had just recently been retested.
Okay.
With respect to the letter that defense counsel brought up, first of all, it's our belief that both the Robert Ishmael letters as well as the Lisa Kerr letters, the defense counsel has waived objection by purposefully not objecting below, and that therefore review is precluded in this case. Should your honors choose to review this, the standard would be plain error, and it is our belief that when confronted with the overwhelming evidence in this case, the judge did not commit plain error by refusing to overturn the conviction. But
your overwhelming evidence is really the one fingerprint and the mitochondrial DNA test after the initial statement had been there wasn't anything in that hair that was testable. You wound up with the mitochondrial DNA test as opposed to the nuclear DNA test, right?
Correct. Initial statement was that no nuclear DNA testing could be done. That's the only type of DNA testing that the ATF lab performs. So once they made the decision that no nuclear DNA was present, meaning no hair follicle or cellular material of that type, then it was submitted to a lab that does mitochondrial DNA analysis. And to answer your first question, certainly our two favorite parts of evidence are the fingerprints and the DNA. But we also believe that it's highly probative circumstantial evidence that less than 2 months before the defendant had threatened to break the defendant physically and financially and had threatened his life. The victim, I'm sorry. And additionally, that he had access to these materials, that he had a P.O. box at the post office where the FedEx label had come from, that he told investigators at the time he was arrested that his fingerprints could be on the mousetrap, which was the triggering device in the bomb, because he had been in that same store touching those mousetraps before. And additionally, the shotgun primers, which were found at the defendant's last known residence, the primers inside those shotgun shells matched primers that were inside the bomb as part of the shrapnel.
This 1950s vintage?
Correct, and that those shotguns had not been manufactured in over 50 years. So all of that evidence combined, we believe, does create absolutely overwhelming evidence in this case. Furthermore, we believe that...
So then why did you need the obscene gesture?
Well, Judge, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and if you look at the picture, it is very clear. While the testimony of the witnesses could be subject to cross-examination and otherwise to different types of attack, when you look at that photo, you can see exactly how the defendant felt about the victim in this case. And that is powerful evidence. And while, in the defendant's opinion, it was one-sided evidence, most of the government's evidence is, of course, one-sided evidence, we don't feel that it was unduly prejudicial. It certainly was not shocking, as Judge Wood points out. It was not emotional. It was not otherwise inflammatory. And therefore, we don't feel that the prejudicial value substantially outweighed the probative value in this case. Finally, with respect to the defendant's sentence, it was absolutely reasonable and proportional to the crime, which was attempted murder. And therefore, we would ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. Anything further, Mr. Fitzgibbon?
This was a close case. This was a case when the government had very tenuous evidence against Robert Smith, There was the fingerprint, but as discussed earlier, Smith was unable to effectively challenge the fingerprint evidence. In addition, there was the hair, but the hair was originally untestable, and then it wasn't tested for 19 months after the incident. The primers were suspiciously found a year and a half after the incident and 8 months following Smith's incarceration after a tip that the police received. And the circumstantial evidence that the government is pointing to supports the defense theory of a possible frame-up by Leo Bick just as much as it supports Robert Smith's guilt. There is no question that these two men had animosity towards each other, and there is also little question that Leo Bick would love to have Robert Smith out of his life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgibbon.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzgibbon, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thanks very much.